Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are continuing our verse-by-verse, chapter-by-chapter exposition on the book of 1 Samuel. Turn to Numbers 25. By now you should know how this works. Turn to Numbers 25, because to really understand what we're going to see in the second chapter of 1 Samuel, we have to understand something that we already learned back in Numbers 25. So turn there. It would be real easy to read the second chapter of 1 Samuel and miss the fact that God is very sovereignly, very providentially bringing about events that we're all actually quite familiar with. We all know the story of the fact that Eli's two sons were not good guys. We introduced that last week. But all of us kind of, if we had any kind of Old Testament education growing up, if we had some Sunday school lessons, we know that the two sons of Eli were a big problem, and we're going to talk tonight about what that problem is, because it's a problem that is still pervasive in far too much of the church world. So we're going to get into that. But it is not an isolated incident. It's not something that just happened to occur. It's not just happenstance. It actually is a very sovereign, providential moment by a God who actually deals in compatibilism. We've spoken of compatibilism a lot here in this little church. Somebody give me a working definition for compatibilism.
Our actions fall in line with God's will.
Very good, Devante. It's a good thing you were here. It means that our actions, even the sinful activity of human beings, still falls under the headship and control of a completely sovereign God. In other words, the actions of human beings, all actions of human beings, are compatible with the ultimate will of God. Otherwise, you end up having to say that God, in his divine sovereignty, is attempting to do things, but the human will and human determination can overthrow the plan of God. And so it's just real lucky that things keep working out God's way. But the biblical presentation, and there are several real clear, real obvious examples of it, the biblical presentation is that God is so sovereign that even the wickedness of human beings and the things that they do that appear to be anti-God or inspired by hate of God, even those things ultimately play into God's predestined outcome. I'll give you a couple good examples. One of the most obvious Old Testament examples is Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers. Terrible thing, awful thing. No way to justify that. They take Joseph's coat, they dip it in animal blood, they take it back to their dad, and they say, Joseph's dead. Terrible. There's no way to justify that or say that that's good activity. However, years go by, God brings a famine to Israel. The remaining brothers, save Benjamin, go to see Pharaoh in Egypt because there's food in Egypt. They end up standing in front of their brother Joseph. They don't know it's him. You know the story. When he finally reveals himself, they're terrified because they realize that he is now the second most powerful man in Egypt, and they sold him into slavery, and they lied to his dad, and they hated him, and now he has the power to judge them, to kill them, to imprison them. They're terrified by it, and he says to them, "You meant it for evil." So the biblical record is there's no question what their intention was. You meant it for evil. But God, says Joseph, meant it for good to bring about this present outcome to save many people alive. In other words, Joseph's very high view of the sovereignty of God was such that it embraced even these terrible things that happened to him because he was able to see the end result, which was that God was preserving the 12 tribes of Israel in the way that Joseph ended up in Egypt and became second only to Pharaoh. So Joseph's attitude was, you meant it for evil. There's no question. What you did was evil, and you meant it to be evil. God meant it for good. Well, that's what we're talking about when we say compatibilism. God entered into the things they did that were completely wrong and evil and brought about his ultimate good. And that's the sort of completely sovereign God we're dealing with. The most obvious example in the Bible of God's remarkable compatibilism is that Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were gathered together to do whatever God's hand predestined to be done. And what did they do? Kill Jesus, the only innocent one. The most heinous crime in the history of humanity, the only truly, genuinely good, innocent one, was tortured, beaten, nailed to a piece of wood, and killed by evil, wicked men who, in their evil, wicked hearts, did the evil, wicked things they were determined to do, which was eliminate the only holy, righteous one. That's a terrible thing. God meant it for good, because the end result of that was that you and I are going to heaven. You and I are saved as a result of wicked men doing wicked and terrible things. So you get the big picture of this kind of compatibilism? God is able to enter into bad things people do and utilize those things in such a sovereign, providential way that they end up serving his ultimate purpose. And we're going to see an example of this tonight. And it would have been an easy example to miss unless you take a little time, do a little detective work, and connect a few dots. Are you in Numbers 25?
Yep. Yeah.
All right. You may recall this story. We're going to start in verse 11. You may recall that Aaron, who was Moses' brother, became high priest. How did Aaron become high priest? God chose him. Electing, choosing starts very, very early. And God chose Aaron to be high priest, and his posterity was going to be high priest. But then God killed two of his four sons, Nadab and Abihu. Yeah, why did he kill them? Yep, strange fire. Because God has the absolute right to say, this is how you approach me. You approach me like this and no other way. When you approach me, make sure you have this sacrifice. Make sure you're wearing these clothes. Make sure you come in on this day. Make sure that there's showbread on that table. Make sure that the candles are lit. And make sure that when you come in front of me, it says holiness to the Lord on your forehead. And make sure that there is a particular kind of incense burning on the altar of incense. If you get any of that wrong, I'll kill you. Because God is real serious about his worship. And he's real serious about saying how it is that people enter into his presence. How do they approach him? When do they approach him? By what means do they approach him? So, being that serious a God, laying out those kinds of serious rules, Nadab and Abihu decided God didn't really mean that. Sure, he said that, but what he probably meant was, take your best shot. And if you want to do it a different way, have at it. And if you don't like the particular mixture of incense I prefer, then do it your way. By all means, just bring a different incense. So they brought a different incense. They thought they could improve on it. Sure, I know what God said. But he didn't mean that. He meant something else. He meant I could, by my own free will and my own volition, I could take what he said, change it, mold it, form it, make it fit me better. So they brought in their strange incense. And as soon as they did, God killed them dead. Now, of course, you may recall that it became a custom within Israel that whenever the high priest would enter the holiest place on the Day of Atonement, that they began tying a rope around his foot because God had a reputation for just killing high priests. By the way, since we're all agreed that that's how God acted in the Old Testament, did that God change?
No.
No. Did any aspect of that God's character or nature change?
No.
Is he still able then to say, this is how you approach me?
Yes.
Is he able to be so specific that he says, you approach me this way or I kill you?
Yes.
Is that still okay? So then when Jesus walked around saying things like, I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life, no man comes to the Father but by me, is that a fair limitation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's completely the same as the God all the way through the Bible who says how you approach him.
Don't tremble at my word.
Yeah. You have to tremble at his word. Exactly. And fear of the Lord is the very beginning of wisdom. So you don't get the opportunity to do things your way. Now, the point of bringing all this up is that Aaron had four sons, and very early on, God kills two of them. So there are two sons remaining, Eleazar and Ithamar. And between those two family lineages, there is a period of time when each of those descendant families become high priest. But back here in Numbers 25, let's start at verse 11. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among Israel, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore I say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and for his descendants after him a covenant for a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God, and he made atonement for the sons of Israel. Now there's a promise God just made to the descendants of Eleazar and the family lineage from that point forward. Phinehas's family line, which is the Eleazar line, is going to be high priest in perpetuity now, according to this covenant. Except that by the time we get to 1 Samuel and we start reading about the family of Eli, Eli is not a descendant of Eleazar. So what are you going to do about this promise? Because this covenant exists, but the high priest family at the time is not the Eleazar lineage. In fact, it's the Ithamar lineage from which Eli comes. So what is God going to do about that? Go to 1 Samuel now. God has to somehow satisfy his own promise. He has to satisfy his own covenant that he has made to the Eleazar lineage. Through Phinehas, through that family line, they will be high priests forever in perpetuity. But that's not what's happening in Israel at the moment. Now, we don't really know how it is. You can read all the way through the Bible. You can read all the commentaries you want. We don't really know how it is that the Ithamar family line became high priest. We simply know that at this moment, that's the way it is. What we know about Eli and his two sons, who are just wicked evil, we're going to talk about that tonight and talk about what kind of wickedness, what kind of evil they were involved in. This family line has to be done away with. And God doesn't just do away with them. He does away with them systematically and as a whole family group. He even gets to the point of taking out cousins. He's going to get rid of the Ithamar family line. And he's going to raise up a fellow named Zadok. Have you ever heard that name? Zadok is then going to become high priest during the time of Solomon. David actually starts to put him in place. Solomon establishes Zadok as high priest. He is, in fact, of the family line of Eleazar, and that high priestly line continues all the way till Jesus. So the question is, how did God solve the problem of the fact that he had made a covenant promise to the lineage of Eleazar, and yet the Ithamar family line is the high priest? He makes such a dramatic decision that he wipes out that whole family line in order to raise up the Eleazar family line. And how and why does he wipe out that line? Because they really are actually that evil. Here's the compatible part. They really are wicked and they really are evil. Does that put them outside the will of God? No, actually it plays perfectly into the will and determination of God, because God has to get rid of that family line anyway, because he made a covenant over here to the Eleazar line. That's the kind of sovereignty we're talking about here. Did everybody follow that? Got any questions about it? Now we can jump into the text. It's 7:45, and that was, in fact, all introduction. So good luck to all of us. And the bad luck for you is I have nowhere to be. So
I think that my girls is on the way here.
Good. Good thinking. Thinking ahead. I like that kind of proactive approach. All right, we're in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, and I believe we got as far as verse 12 last week. We got through verse 11. We got through Hannah's song of thanksgiving. We're starting in verse 12, which begins describing the problem with Eli's sons. And then there's a little parenthetical comment about Samuel growing up as a boy. And then it goes back to talking about Eli's sons. So let's talk about these guys. Now, the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. There's the problem right there. They did not know the Lord, and they did not know the custom of the priests with the people. In other words, they not only didn't know God, but they didn't know the rules, the standards, the laws, the traditions of how the high priests were supposed to act among the people. So they just started making up their own rules. And those rules kind of look like this. When any man was offering a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come in while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Then he would thrust it into the pan or the kettle or the cauldron or the pot, and all that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. Why is that a problem? Because the Levitical rules are very clear about what portion belongs to the priest. Some of it belongs to the priest, some belongs to the Levites, some can be eaten by the priest's family. God is very clear about every sacrifice, how it's to be divided up. Certain parts of it, like the fat, have to be burned. And they're going to sidestep that rule as well. And instead, what they did was, because they were apparently well-fed fellows, instead what they did was make sure that they got the first and the best of everything. And so as soon as a sacrifice was brought in and it was beginning to be cooked, they would come in with a three-pronged fork, we're told, and they didn't even do it. They had servants that would go in and do it for them, threaten people with the power of the high priest, and take their big prongs and just dig out the best of the meat and take off with it. In other words, they hated the sacrifices of God and preferred themselves over God's glory. And they were willing to change God's very clear directions, very didactic directions about how you do the worship of God. They were willing to sidestep that in favor of enriching themselves. Does any of this sound familiar?
Yes.
Because it goes on all over the place in the modern church, which is why I said a few minutes ago that the God of the Old Testament is still the God in heaven today. He hasn't changed at all. He hasn't changed one iota, hasn't changed one whit. He still is very insistent that his worship and the way that he is approached and the way that his church and his worship is established is all about holiness and righteousness and that it glorifies him. But as soon as you put human beings into anything that has to do with God, they will bring all of their sinfulness and all of their depravity with them, and they will attempt to use the platform of God or the worship of God or the assembly of God as a springboard for their own ego, enrichment, self-aggrandizement. And we see it all the time, and God is going to end up cursing this whole family line for this kind of behavior. And yet, despite the fact that this is what God is like, and despite the Nadab and Abihu kind of examples, despite all the high priests that died inside the Holy of Holies, despite Eli's sons and ultimately Eli's death and curse, people don't bother to read it. They don't bother to read the text, read the Bible, look at what God is like, and then shudder, worry, that you're actually dealing with this kind of God. People have no fear of God at all, as Gladys was just getting at. People no longer quake at the reality that they are dealing with an absolutely righteous, holy God, and that his standards are real standards. I think the problem is that because human beings have gotten away with it for a while, they think they're getting away with it for good. Just because God has been long-suffering and hasn't brought down punishment immediately, he's been remarkably long-suffering, so because people have gotten away with it, they think they're always going to get away with it. That's why it's so important that both in the Old and the New Testament it's repeated, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay." Just because you get away with it for 70 down here doesn't mean you get away with it forever. And if it's true that God does not change, then if you mess up his worship in order to aggrandize yourself or in order to change his rules to make them more compatible to what you prefer, if you do that your whole lifetime and have to stand in front of him in judgment, I think you're going to have a real bad day, because he doesn't change. And he's the same God who acts like this. Now, their first problem, these two boys, was that they took all the good food. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Verse 15 says, also, before they burned the fat, which was a rule in the Levitical law, you had to burn off the fat, before they would even burn it, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give the priest meat for roasting, as he will not take boiled meat from you, but only raw. Now, there's a couple things going on there. The first was breaking the rule where God said, in my sacrifice, you burn all that fat. And before they'd ever get a chance to cook it, the priest's servants would come and say, give it to me raw. Don't even cook it. Don't burn it to God, which is where it belongs. Give it to the priest. And when the priest had raw meat, he could sell it on the market. And since it was then his meat, he could make money off it. So it becomes a means of self-enrichment at the cost of the worship of God, despite the fact that the Pentateuch could not be more clear. The law could not be more clear. The Torah couldn't be more exacting. This is how you do the sacrifice of God. They didn't want to do it that way. They want to do it the way where they benefit. It was not sufficient for them that God benefit. It was not sufficient for them that God get glory. And by the way, it's a very human characteristic that it's hard for us to grasp the idea of the destruction of good things for God's glory. That's just hard for us. And the more humanistically we think, the more likely we are to say, well, why would you waste that? There's hungry people over here. Wouldn't God rather that we feed the hungry people? That, by the way, was exactly the problem that Judas had when he said about the oil. Why this waste? We could have sold that oil and we could have given the money to the poor. And then, of course, John tells us parenthetically, I think it was John that added it, that Judas didn't care about the poor. He carried the bag. He knew where the money was. He wanted the money. And that's the problem humans have. They're willing to enrich themselves on the back of the worship of God, but then we have this remarkable ability to justify our evil and say, it's not that bad. After all, I'm helping these people over here. Think of the children, the people, the humans, the poor, the lame, the crippled. What about them? God would want me to take care of them, wouldn't he? No! God puts himself first. God always puts himself first. Always. And if you're on God's side, you put God first always. And if God, who owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, says, destroy that for my glory, then you destroy that for God's glory. If God says, give an offering sacrificially, you give an offering sacrificially. And you don't worry about what could have been held back or how it could have been used or what you could have done better with it. It's God's. God wants it. You give it to God. And once you've given it away to God, that's the end of it. It belongs to God. Yes, sir?
Something you had said a moment ago, I'm thinking about Psalms chapter 50, 21, you know what it says, you know. But it says, these things hast thou done, I kept silence. Thou thoughtest that I was altogether such as one as thyself, but I will reprove thee and set thee in order before thine eyes. So this is talking to me.
Yeah. Well, the Bible is full of that kind of language. You thought I was altogether like you, and I'm not. Isaiah saying, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts, and my ways higher than your ways. We've talked a lot here about the fact that not only does the Bible say God is not like us, And God takes the time, as you just quoted, to say, I'm not like you. But the part that human beings seem to have trouble getting a hold of is not only is God not like us, but we're not like God. And our ego, our natural sinful ego, wants to make gods of ourselves, want to be equal with God. If God says something, we think that our opinion is on par with God's opinion. And that if we don't like God's opinion, we ought to alter God's opinion to bring it in line with what we think. God says, destroy this. We say, no, not fair. I'll do something more fair with it. Well, the problem with these boys was they weren't distributing anything to anybody. They were just enriching themselves off the worship of God. So, starting in verse 16, if the man said, they must surely burn the fat first. He's right. He's quoting the Levitical rules. I can't just give you the fat. We have to burn that first. If they said that, and then once we've burned it, you can take as much as you desire. In other words, we're going to do it God's way, and then the high priest can have whatever cooked meat he wants to take. If they would say that, then the servant would say, no, but you shall give it to me now, and if not, I will take it from you by force. So now we've gone beyond just individual free will sacrifice into the area of forced extraction of other people's gifts that they bring to God, taking it to these priests. It's very similar to, if I can apply this for a moment. May I apply this for a moment? Sure, Jim, go ahead. Okay, I will. It's very similar to the kind of guilt giving that goes on in so many churches. Anybody here ever given out of guilt? Yay! Yeah, Tom and I come out of a church where we were told if you weren't at least in that 28% tithe range, you were on your way to hell. It was said to us, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, if you don't, here was the quote, if you don't trust God with your wallet, then you don't trust God at all. And we believe that stuff. And we would, boy, we were like the Pharisees, making sure we had 10% of every little mint and cumin. I mean, we were, every dollar we got. And by the way, was it out of your gross or out of your net, Tom?
Gross.
It was out of your gross, exactly. You can't fool God. He knows what you bring home, but he knows what your real paycheck was.
Give to God before the government.
You give to God before the government. That was the phrase. Oh, yeah. I mean, we were just raised on this stuff where we actually believe that if we came up anything short of the tithes and offerings that we were required to bring, that we were enemies of God and we were on our way. Anyway. But that kind of forced giving still exists in so much of the church world. I just want to draw that parallel because over here it is said to be a wrong activity, a sinful activity, and the problem with it is that it takes away the genuine worship of God and replaces it with a forced extraction. You know, Peter in the New Testament takes the time to speak to preachers. We have a couple of our deacons here tonight that fill the pulpit in my absence. We have another elder here this evening. We are told collectively, any of us who take any kind of leadership role in the church, we're told by Peter that we are to be examples to the flock. And then he uses the phrase, not lording it over God's inheritance. The word pastor, poimen, means shepherd. It does not mean master. It does not mean entertainer. It does not mean the king. It does not mean, you know, the most powerful guy in the room. To genuinely be a pastor means to be servant. That analogy of pastor and sheep is so perfectly applicable because as any shepherd will tell you, and I'm sure you all know lots of shepherds who will tell you. Everybody here familiar with shepherds? But as any shepherd will tell you, you can't drive sheep. You can drive cattle. You can push cattle and they'll go. But you can't drive sheep. You have to lead sheep. Sheep follow. So it's a perfect analogy. But we're told in the New Testament that we who care for the sheep are not the great shepherd. Christ is the great shepherd. We are under shepherds. In other words, we are caring for sheep that don't belong to us. which is why we're told again, remember who the sheep belong to. They belong to him. Which means he has the right to do with them as he pleases because they belong to him. But we don't have the right to do with them as we please because they don't belong to us. In other words, we have to follow the rules that the great shepherd puts in place when he tells us how to care and feed for his sheep. In other words, they're not ours, so we can't fleece them because they're not ours to fleece. And yet preacher and preacher and pastor and church that I know of work very hard to fleece the sheep and guilt them into giving, take the best of what they have, enrich themselves, and again use what should be the worship of God as an opportunity to set themselves up as kings and rulers over their little church fiefdoms. And the same God who's going to curse these men for their activity is still alive and well today. All right, we got to plow forward. Have I made my point?
Yes.
You got it? Okay. Verse 17. Because they acted that way, thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord. Look at that language very specifically, because this is God's perspective of it. Doesn't matter what their perspective was. It doesn't matter how many people say, well, we're just going to change this a little bit because we can justify it. We're going to change it a little bit because we're going to help these people over here. It doesn't matter how well you can talk your way into the idea that you're justified in doing it a different way than the way that God prescribes doing it. It only matters what God thinks of it. God's perspective is the only perspective that counts. And you're not going to have much opportunity to argue with him because he is jealous for his worship. And anything you do that gets in the way of that, interferes with that, especially if your interference with it directs some amount of that worship back to you, to yourself, then you are working, get this straight, you are working in league with Satan himself, whose problem from the beginning was that he was raised up because of his beauty, and said, I will put my throne in the place of the north. I will be worshipped as God. And ever since then, the worship of God has been under attack by forces that want to redirect his worship toward anything other than him. And human beings leap into the middle of that far too naturally, participate in that satanic, genuinely evil concept and say, I want to misdirect your worship a little bit away from God toward me, more me. You're not talking like Christ when you're talking like that. You're talking like Satan when you're talking like that. He has always intended to misdirect God's worship toward anything other than God, and humans far too willingly fall into that trap and put themselves between humans and God and interrupt that worship to make it about themselves. It's a terrible crime because God sees it as absolute hatred, despising the offerings and the worship that are directed to God. So God's real dramatic about this stuff. Now at this moment, this chapter parenthetically talks for a moment about Samuel. So we'll read that, and then we'll get back to these boys, and then we'll wrap it up. Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy wearing a linen ephod. That word ephod shows up two different ways in the Old Testament. One is as a woven garment, and the priests all wear these woven garments, usually with blue and purple and scarlet in them. And so he's being dressed as a priest from the time he's a young boy, being raised in Eli's house. So he's got this linen ephod that he wears. And his mother would make him a little robe, apparently to wear over that ephod. And she would bring it to him from year to year when she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord. And they went to their own home. And the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. And the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Verse 22. Now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel and how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Okay, now we've amped it up again. Not only were they taking the offerings, not only were they taking the best of the offerings, not only were they selling the offerings in the marketplace, not only were they breaking very clear rules about what needed to be burned, but now the women who are around the gate there, who are impressed with their power and authority, because they do have money and power, those women they then take advantage of and are sleeping with these women. And they're doing this in front of Israel, because they're at Shiloh, they're at the place of worship before David establishes Jerusalem as the capital there. And so the people are required to come to Shiloh. They're required to come there and bring their offerings. And when they come and bring their offerings, they have to deal with these guys. And so it becomes a blight on the worship of God. And Eli, very importantly, the father, doesn't stop them. And that's why God is going to punish Eli. He's going to be very specific and say, why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you? These are your boys. These are your kids. Why did you let them get away with this?
You could have done what Phinehas did.
And by the way, when Phinehas did it, God gives him an ongoing covenant. Your family will always be high priest, because God is actually that jealous of his worship. So the contrast is huge here, isn't it? Yeah. So Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to Israel and how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good, which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? That's a heavy, deep theological question. He said, now if a man sins against another man, if Jean Tu and I have an argument, and something that I do, I sin against Jean Tu in some way, call him some inappropriate name, take something from him, throw some inappropriate curse his way, I've done something where I really sinned against him, then Jean Tu can go to God and say, you got to help me out here. What is Jim up to? And God will intercede on Jean Tu's part. God will be an intercessor between brothers in the Lord, or in this case, between Israelites. But then the question arises, but if your sin is against God, who's going to intercede? If I do to God what I did to Jean Tu, can Jean Tu intercede for me? Yeah, is he going to be able to go to God and say, it's okay, God, I got this one. No, I've got this covered. I've worked it out with Jim. We're going to be okay. No, once your sin is against a righteous, holy God, then who can intercede? By the way, if you want some concept of how serious a sin against God is, I think I can help you understand it with one word. Hell. God created hell. God created lake of fire. God created eternal punishment. God created something called outer darkness, where Jesus himself, who would know, said that people who end up there, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. These are good old Hebraisms that basically mean it's just going to be awful. There's going to be nothing but crying, weeping, wailing, people grinding their teeth in pain and agony in an outer darkness so far away from the light of God. And all of this exists because sovereign God determined it would exist.
Right. I used to wonder how they could be that hot and that dark. And then I found out about this deep black holes where the magnetism is so great that it won't even let the heat.
Won't even let the light out. Yeah. Isn't it interesting that modern science is starting to confirm that actually some of these concepts can and do exist? But they exist on purpose, is the point. They exist because they're part of God's divine plan. They exist because God is going to utilize them, is utilizing them, has utilized them, in order to say, I really am that holy. I really am that righteous. And if you sin against me, this is my judgment. Now, what are you going to do about that? Because he's righteous and holy. He has angels around his head crying to one another, holy, holy, holy. He's encased himself in a light that no man approaches. And then there's you. And what are you going to do? Now, is there anybody in the room who's willing to say that in their life, from birth until this moment, you've never sinned against God? Anyone? 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 Aiden, except that his parents. Parents shook their heads. No. Wow, Aiden, you didn't even get off on a technicality. Except that the Bible says that children come out of the womb speaking lies.
That's right.
So, Ephesians 2, people are born dead in their trespasses and sins. I mean, people are born sinful. And if we're sinful by nature, if we're depraved by nature, who is that sin against?
God.
Against God. We're sinful in comparison to him. We're sinful in comparison to his righteousness and his holiness. And so what are you going to do? Who's going to intercede for you? It's such a wonderful question. Who can intercede when you sin against God? And everybody in the room is guilty. This is why the good news is such good news. This is why the word gospel is one of my favorite words. Because the answer to the question is, only God can intercede between you and God. No human can do it. No human is righteous enough that he could have a hearing with God to even plead your case. You're going to have somebody who has unlimited access to God and has a sufficient price, a sufficient payment, a sufficient case that he can argue that you should be accepted. So this wonderful question, who can intercede when you've sinned against God? There's only one answer. And the Bible provides that answer, Christ and Christ alone. The man who is God is the only one who can intercede between you and God. And he has the sufficient price. He has the price of his own blood, the sacrifice of his own life. Yeah. So this wonderful question is raised to these boys who don't have, by the way, Christ, who don't know God, who haven't been following any of the rules. He says, who is going to intercede for you? If a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father. For the Lord desired, what are the next words? To put them to death. On Sunday morning, remember we were talking about this? Sovereignty and salvation. And we talked about sovereignty and reprobation. And we read, God will give them a strong delusion that they will believe a lie and be damned. I mean, that's really, really sovereign. Here it says they would not listen to their father. Their father is completely right. The advice he's giving them is completely right. Don't do this. This is wrong. How are you going to stand before God? Who can intercede for you? And they would not listen. And Samuel, who wrote this book, takes the time to tell us they did not listen because God wanted to kill them. That's why they wouldn't listen.
Sound like a judicial hardening, if you will.
Absolutely. But now we ask the question, why? Why did God want them dead? Did he only want them dead because they were that wicked? Well, there's a lot of other wicked people around. Why these two boys? Why do they have a target on their back? Why is God out to kill these guys? So that he could raise up Zadok the priest and the lineage of Eleazar, because he made a promise back in the book of Numbers that that family line would always be the high priest. So God made a covenant way back there in the book of Numbers. Hundreds of years have passed. And now God is going to keep that promise. Turn to 1 Kings. Keep your finger right there in 1 Samuel. We'll do a little more detective work. 1 Kings chapter 2. This has to do with the very last of the lineage of Eli's family. This guy, Abiathar, or Abiathar, he's the last of the family lineage of Eli, and the last of the Ithamar line of priests. I'm in 1 Kings 2, look at verse 25. So King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him so that he died. Then to Abiathar, the priest, the king said, "Go to Anathoth, to your own field, for you deserve to die. But I will not put you to death this time. You carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, and because you were afflicted in everything with which my father was afflicted, so Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being the priest of the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord which God had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh." So what we're about to read in Samuel is God saying, your whole family line, your whole lineage is going to be destroyed. And by the time you get to 1 Kings 2, that has happened. And the writer of 1 Kings takes the time to say, because God said this is what he was going to do to this family line. So that's my biblical justification for what I just said about God wanting a cause to kill these boys. He was determined to kill them because he had made a promise that the ongoing lineage of high priests was not going to go through the Ithamar line, but through the Eleazar line. Everybody up with that? Okay, we just got a few verses to read and we're done for the night. Go back to 2 Samuel. Go back to 1 Samuel. Don't go back to 2 Samuel. Go back to 1 Samuel. We're going to wrap this up. Because now we're going to get to the promise of the destruction of that family. We are in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 26. Now the boy Samuel was growing in stature and favor, both with the Lord and with men. Then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt in bondage in Pharaoh's house? And did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to carry an ephod before me? And did I not give to the house of your father all the fire offerings of the sons of Israel? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offerings, which I have commanded in my dwelling? Why do you honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel?" Pause one moment, because that's a really important phrase. Why do you prefer your children over me? Now, humanistically, we could say, well, I understand. I mean, Eli loved his sons. Those are his boys. Those are his sons. And they were just doing what came naturally. You know, boys will be boys, priests will be priests. What are you going to do? And God, one more time, places himself above every other human relationship, including family, and says, I'm the important one here. Why did you put your children over me? This is very similar to what Jesus said. It's an uncomfortable reality that in the Bible, Jesus said things like, a man's enemies are going to be those of his own family. And he said, if any man loves father, mother, sister, brother, husband, wife, yea, in his own life also, more than he loves me, he can't be my disciple. Because if in fact you're worshiping the real God, if in fact you are naming the name of Jesus Christ, then your life has to be utterly and completely Christocentric, theocentric. He gets all the glory, he gets all the honor, and everything else takes a back seat to that. And that's hard for us because we're humans. And we love our kids and we love our friends and we love our mom and dad and we love our family. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you use your human love for other people as an excuse to put them ahead of the proper worship, the right worship, the directed worship of God, then you have chosen wrongly, unwisely, and God is going to correct you one of two ways. He's either going to correct you in the here and now, because whom the Lord loves, he chastens, or he's going to let you just keep doing that, and he's going to correct you eternally. But either way, God will get the priority. Either way, he will defend himself. He's a jealous God. Verse 30. Therefore, the Lord God of Israel declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever, but now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. And you will see the distress of my dwelling. In spite of all that I do good for Israel, and an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will not cut off every man of yours from my altar, that your eyes may fail from weeping and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of your life. In other words, I'm not going to kill you all right now. This is treacherous. Listen to what God's saying. I'm not just going to wipe you out all at once, which he can do. Remember Korah? I mean, he can open up the earth and just swallow people if he wants to. He could wipe out the whole family line. He says, I'm not going to do that. In fact, I'm going to let you live for a little while so that you can see the shame of your family line. And you're never going to stop weeping over it. And you're going to see the way that your lineage is going to be destroyed. You're going to get to see this as I visited upon you. He's punishing Eli for not stepping up and doing what was right among his own children. And you're going to see the distress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I do for Israel. And there'll be no old men. In other words, you're going to live longer. Just watch them die. They're going to grow up to be young men. They're going to die. You're going to see men cut off in their youth. And I'm going to cut off your lineage. And this will be the sign to you, verse 34. And this will be the sign to you which shall come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day, both of them shall die. But I will raise up for myself. I love that phraseology. You see it a lot. God saying, I will do this for myself. Apparently you can't do it. Apparently nobody can do it. Apparently humans can't do it. You won't do it. I'm going to do this myself because it's the only way this is going to get done. I will raise up for myself. This is a phrase that you even see carried into the New Covenant, the New Testament. How is it that there's going to be an intercessor between man and God? God's going to have to raise up one himself because nobody else is going to be able to do it. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. So, it's true. He raises up Zadok. Zadok's family lineage, as I said, carries all the way through to Christ, and so they do walk before the anointed, the Messiah, always. By the way, when did the office of the high priest, when was it finally abolished? Who's the last high priest? I should put it that way. Who was the last high priest? Jesus! Jesus is the last high priest. He's the final high priest. That's what the writer of Hebrews is going to tell us. He is the final great high priest. What family lineage is he from? Who? From the tribe of Judah. Wait, high priests don't come from Judah. They come from Levi. So what's his high priestly lineage? Melchizedek. Exactly. Meaning that God, all the way back there in Genesis, established a completely separate priesthood line. So while all these different human priesthood lines are going on, God is making covenants and promises for all these different priestly lines, killing some, raising up others, doing all that. Meanwhile, he's got this priestly lineage all the way back here at Melchizedek in the book of Genesis. And then the writer of Hebrews says that's the high priestly line that Christ comes from. And then, of course, he argues that Melchizedek is a Christophany because only Christ could ever establish his own priestly line and keep it perfectly forever. Whenever men are involved in it, there's going to be sin and depravity in it, and you're going to see all these kind of problems in it. But there is one, only one, genuine high priestly line that serves perfectly before God, and that's Christ through Melchizedek. And we see all these human lines and all the problems that they continually cause. Yes, sir.
He don't need other words, it is finished.
Say that again. I'm all the way up here.
Christ, when he uttered the words, it is finished, you'll find that, you know, I mean, that made everything, it was, everything else obsolete, if you will. He's the fulfillment of all of that. So,
yep.
I mean, they were still offering lamb, even while the Lamb of God was still was upon the cross. So, I mean, all of that, the veil before the temple was rent in two, yep. Access. And like you said, yep. The Hebrews, he had to really show the Hebrews the how Christ is superior, if you will, and all of that. You know?
Absolutely. That is the point. He is superior to all of that. A higher, better high priest for a higher, better covenant based on better promises. So yes, you're absolutely right. Christ is our high priest. He is the final high priest. Verse 36, and it shall come about that everyone who is left in your house shall come and bow down to him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and they will say, please assign me to one of the priest's office so that I may eat a piece of bread. He's going to so impoverish them and so take them out of the priestly lineage that they're going to end up coming and begging to the priest, saying, just give me a job. Just put me to work in the temple somewhere. Just, I've got to make some money. Put me in somewhere. And he says, that's going to be the shame of your lineage to your family, and I'm going to keep you alive long enough to see that shame. So God is really punishing Eli. Now, the big picture in all of that, what I really wanted to drive at was, I started the night by saying, this is yet another example of God's remarkable compatibilism. God made a promise to the family line of Eliezer, all the way back there in the book of Numbers. And he is going to keep that promise in Zadok during the time of David and into the time of Solomon and carry that good priesthood forward all the way to the time of Jesus. And the wrong family line was in the priesthood by the time Eli was priest. So not only did God have to get them out of the way and take them out of the priesthood, but he had to do it in keeping with his justice and righteousness. And so he utilized their evil tendencies, their natural proclivity toward their own ego and sinfulness, in order to blind them to the genuine worship of God so that they would hate his sacrifices, so that they would abuse the people. And even when their father wisely gave them counsel not to be like that, God made sure that they didn't hear it because it was God's intention to kill them. And then God did kill them and punish Eli and did raise up a priest, exactly like he said, from the family lineage of Eliezer, who would be good priests. And so we just leapt from Numbers through 1 Samuel into 1 Kings to see all the bits and pieces and parts that all fit together to show that God kept his word to the promise he made in a covenant to a particular family lineage, and he carried it out through the wickedness and sinfulness of other people in order to establish the thing he said he was going to do, because he never forgets a promise. He always performs every promise he's ever made. He makes sure that he has to move people, nations, use people's wretchedness and sinfulness, use other people's goodness, and move them about like checkers in order to bring about exactly what he said he was going to do, to establish his own righteousness and holiness, to establish his own worship. And that's the same God who made promises to you. And that's the same God who said that whoever comes to his son would never perish but have everlasting life. Why do I believe those promises? Why am I willing to stand on the promises of the Bible and say God said it and that's that? It's because he has this long, rich history in his word of keeping his own word in such remarkably sovereign ways that he can use righteous people and sinful people and the wickedness of human beings and the good behaviors of human beings. And if he makes a promise like, okay, your family line's going to be priest, then your family line's going to be priest. And that's just all there is to it. And if he has to kill some people to get them out of the way to keep that promise he made, then that's what that sovereign God is going to do. So you have every reason to walk out of here tonight confident. You have every reason to walk through the rest of your life knowing that you're in the hands of a completely sovereign God who is on your side, who has your best interest at heart, and he is willing to move people and nations And sometimes wicked things are going to happen. Sometimes wicked people and sinful folks are going to get in your way and try to resist you and put you down or make fun of you. Or sometimes wicked people in pulpits are going to try to malign the worship of God or the gospel of Christ. Sometimes things are going to get so crazy in this world that it's going to be hard to see the hand of God in the midst of all of it. So you go back to the Word and back to the Word and back to the Word, and you see that God is consistently faithful no matter what, and He will move through all of those circumstances and events of human life and arrange them and rearrange them and adjust them and move them until they come out exactly the way He said they were going to come out, because He was in charge of all of it to begin with. And that's a great comfort to me when I turn on my computer every day and I see how increasingly insane this world is. And how godless, and how Christ-hating. And it makes me worry, and I think, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh, that's right, God knows what He's doing. He knows exactly what He's doing. And He's going to bring all of this to exactly the conclusion that He wrote about and foreordained and prophesied, and it's all going to come out His way, and He's going to be glorified, and Christ is going to be lifted up, and the people of God are going to be eternally saved and secure, because that's what He said He was going to do. And He's doing it through the wickedness and depravity and sinfulness and craziness of the world in which we live. But He's always been that way. You understand me? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll take that as an amen. So walk out confident. You're on the good side. You're on the we win side. Walk out boldly. Don't be afraid to tell people what it is you believe and why it is you believe it. Because after all, you've got God Himself. He's got your back on this one. Are there any questions about that? Are you glad you were here tonight?
Yes, sir.
Did you learn anything?
Yes.
Good. Isn't it nice connecting the dots in the Bible and watching the way God weaves together this marvelous tapestry? All these different authors writing in all these different places at all these different times, all telling one story. And if you do the detective work, you can go pick a piece from here and a detail from there and a hint from here, and you put it all together, and you can see the way God just sovereignly moves through human history and then took the time to write about it just so He could go, look, there I go again. Look at me go. There I am. I'm doing it again. So that we would have faith in Him, so we would have confidence in Him. And if we learned anything else tonight, we learned that Aiden is corrupt. So this is good. Poor little Aiden. Are there any questions about that?
You had a distinction between when one group worship God, right, they got a covenant of peace.
Speak up a little more, I'm sorry.
You had made a connection or a distinction between one group who worship God correctly, they got a covenant of peace, and we just talked about the people who didn't. When I read covenant of peace, what should I think of as far as, like, peace? Because I know it kind of has...
Yeah. The most consistent biblical definition for the word peace is the stopping or the ceasing of againstness. So if there's a constant againstness going on, that's your situation with God. You're against God and God's against you. Peace is when that againstness stops. And you don't have the power to stop it. You don't have the ability to stop it, nor do you have the will to stop it, because if you're an enemy of God, you're not going to stop it. And that's where God finds all of us, in that enemy depraved state. So He does for us what we can't do, and the end result of it is peace. So He stops the againstness that was between you and Him. So when you read anything about a covenant of peace, then that's God saying, I'm going to make an agreement with you where we're not against each other. We're working together on this. And you'll notice that when He made the covenant to the family line of Eliezer, that when He did it, He didn't put any requirement on Eliezer. He just said, this is my promise. This is my covenant. This is what I'm going to do. Very much like what He said to Abraham. Put Abraham to sleep, and then God passed through the animals Himself, because God was establishing covenant promises that He was going to accomplish by Himself, the end result of which would be that some people were not against God. He was for them and they were for Him. Which is why the writer of Hebrews, when talking about whom the Lord loves, He chastens, And then he extrapolates on that a little bit and says, no chastening at the present is fun, comfortable. But he says it brings about the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So the end result of peace with God is that our lives reflect the righteousness of God. And if you know that you're accepted in God and you know that your life reflects godliness, then you know that you have peace with God. It's what Paul calls the peace that passes understanding. You reach that point where you know you're okay because you're okay with God. And if you're okay with God, you don't care what people think.
So I guess the Hebrew is the same as the Greek?
Yeah, it's the same concept. Yeah, still think of it in terms of war and peace. Those would be the two opposites. You're either at war with God or you're at peace with God. And since you can't make peace with God through your own effort, he's the peacemaker. That's why Christ is called the Prince of Peace. That word keeps coming up. And every time you see it, think the ending or the stopping of the tension between the two of you.
So not necessarily like peace with enemies per se, because that's kind of what I was thinking when I saw the covenant of peace. I didn't know where to think of between their enemies.
Yeah. Like who are the participants in the covenant?
It's just them and God.
Yeah, just them and God. So if they're the participants in the covenant, the peace is between them. You can have peace with God and still have plenty of enemies here on the planet.
But you forget you're an enemy of God prior to the covenant.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Keep that part.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the new covenant. God is making an unconditional covenant of peace with people who hate him. And then he's going to change them, reform them, and make them love him. It's remarkable.
Amen.
Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
In 1 Samuel 2, where is it, 30, where he says, God says, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever.
Yep.
But now the Lord declares, you know,
yep.
So he's changing what he promised. So
right.
He promised, but he always knew that he was going to cause them to go
yep.
astray.
Now,
I'm
that's okay. I think I can clear it up pretty quickly. The high priesthood that they were part of was under a particular covenant. What covenant was it part of? Where was the priesthood established?
With Moses.
With Moses. Very good. You did know. Mount Sinai, that's the beginning of it. Aaron is going to be the high priest. They are the priests of the covenant. Is that covenant a conditional covenant or an unconditional covenant?
It's conditional.
It's a completely conditional covenant. You'll be in covenant with me as long as you keep my rules. They didn't keep the rules, so he says, okay, then I'm going to give you the curse part. The provision is, as long as you do it my way. They didn't do it his way. The Moses covenant is an utterly, completely conditional covenant. Do it my way, I'll bless you. Don't do it, I'll curse you. And they were the priests of that covenant, so it's a completely conditional covenant. Make sense? Okay. That was a very good question. And in fact, when I read through it, I thought, should we pause here and talk about this? No, I'll keep going. Dawn will pick it up later. So, good for you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.